He's the author of Pope Annalisa, which is the first book in a trilogy that he's creating here. And if you all joined us last time when Peter was here, then you know what a phenomenal, very deep, inspiring individual he is. He's got a fascinating background. Of course, we'll touch on that for anybody who's new and who hasn't had a chance to hear that. But if you haven't heard it, if you don't have it in your iTunes podcast archive, you'll want to go back, I believe it was in 2009, and you'll just find the show Pope Annalisa, and you'll hear that show. So that way you'll be able to pull up the background for this wonderful guest. But this first book, Pope Annalisa, has won 4 national book medals. I mean, he's won both the Nautilus and the Independent Published Book Awards for fiction. The book swept the prestigious Nautilus Book Awards, winning 2 silver medals and 1 gold medal in 2 different categories, in visionary fiction, in spirituality, and many more. He's back with us today, and we're going to be talking about the sacred feminine. We're going to be talking about Gnosticism. We're going to talk about healing. Oh, my goodness, all kinds of fascinating things today. So I'm going to welcome to the line, Peter.
Tamara, nice to be with you again.
Oh, I'm so glad to have you. When Mara contacted me and said, Peter would love to be on your show again, I was like, well, yes.
Well, it's great
definitely.
To be back.
Well, I know that I've got some antiquated information about the wonderful awards and the accolades that Pope Annalisa has won, so I know that you need to bring us up to speed. What else has been happening with that wonderful book?
Well, yeah, you were right about the 4 awards. Since the last time I spoke with you, it's won a 5th award, which is the National Best Book Award. It won in the category for visionary fiction. So that makes like what I think is like 5 awards in 6 months. So I'm really pleased with that because, you know, the awards really help you get a little bit of attention for the book. And obviously the purpose of any author is to be as widely read as possible. So, you know, anything like that that helps it get into the mainstream is a good thing.
It sure is. Well, I know that I loved the book. The book was so riveting that I could not put it down. And just to give you guys a little bit about what the book is, if you haven't seen it, you see that cover here on the page. I mean, there's a sister girl there in the book. She is the reincarnation of Mary Magdalene. She's a Nigerian woman who becomes Pope. She's right there in Vatican City walking around the Pope. So that's fascinating in itself. And it's a book that you just most definitely want to pick up and read. It is a serious novel. But I know that, as I spoke of before, that Peter, this is the first book of a trilogy.
Yes, it is. It's called the First Souls Trilogy. And the First Souls is about the first souls or first spirit to fall into material creation from the spiritual dimension. So it really pretty much traces the origin, destiny, and purpose of humanity. And the trilogy follows the various incarnations of these souls, these seminal souls, throughout different epochs of human history.
Wow, I love it. So when can we expect the second edition?
Well, I'm working on that right now. And the only thing that's kind of taken me a little bit away from that is the heavy-duty marketing for the first book, because it takes a lot to get your book out there. That's why I was saying about the awards are kind of helpful. But I do spend a lot of time marketing Pope Annalisa. And I am, though, working on the second novel, which is called The 13th Disciple. And that novel is actually more directly about Mary Magdalene herself, about the early church, the women of the early church in particular, and what happened to the early Christian movement that made it change so radically from, you know, its earlier and what I would say is decidedly feminine orientation to the church that we all know today.
Wow. Well, I would love for you to go into that a bit, because I find that really fascinating. It just really hit home. Of course, I love to read. I love literature. I love history, especially alternative history, especially when it has to do with religiosity. But first of all, for those of us who are listening here, those who may be new to the family, I'd love for you to give a little bit of information about your background so they know who we're speaking to and where this power is coming from.
Absolutely. I guess the thing that sort of set me on the course for my later life happened when I was in my early 20s, and that was finding out I had the ability to do intuitive medical readings and other things that people might, they use different terms for it. You would call psychic phenomena, kind of out of the ordinary type of things. But I found that I could sort of see what was going on inside of people with just somebody giving me the name, age, and address of a particular person. And when I was a student, I used to do these. I used to practice doing these readings for people in my neighborhood. I lived in kind of a working-class neighborhood in Boston while I was going to school. And I used to give free readings for the folks in the neighborhood. And I used to have lines of people standing outside the door sometimes. And, you know, it was, but anyway, the long and the short of it is that when I realized I was getting this information and I was getting it accurately, it just led me to the realization that we must be connected at some deeper level than we see. Some energetic force must be binding us all together, because how else could I know these things about other people? And that was an uplifting thought for me, because, number one, I felt, well, you know, there really is a higher power out there. We can connect with that higher power, and we can use the information that we derive from that for the benefit of ourselves and for others. And most of all, that we, you know, you hear a lot of gratuitous comments about humanity and about people being connected to one another. Sometimes I don't think people really and truly understand how true that is, but when you actually experience that as an actual event in your life, as opposed to just an intellectual proposition, it's kind of a life-changing thing.
Powerful. And say name, address, and phone number, and you were able to do readings on what was going on in the person's physical body.
Yeah, name, address, and age. They didn't give me the phone number because they probably figured if I called the people, I'd really freak them out. But
I was just joking on that part. But wow, that's amazing. That is amazing, huh? Well, I would certainly say that would qualify you for this great work that you're doing, because I would just say that maybe part of Annalisa's gifts came from you.
I think that every author puts a piece of himself or pieces of him or herself into the characters and into the work they write. And it wasn't long after finishing the book that I had a chance to look at it from a little bit of a distance. And yeah, I really did see aspects of my personality, not one aspect, but many aspects of my personality, because I think we're all complex individuals in the character of Annalisa and in the other characters. So that in some ways, I think what you write about is a little bit about yourself, but certainly there were parts of other people that I had met in my life. I did model Annalisa as a composite off of maybe a couple of different remarkable women that I had met in my life, one in particular. And so it was really kind of a combination of all those things. But yeah, you do put parts of yourself, I think, in every book that you write.
I think you would, and you know, many artists. I mean, you can't help it. Any kind of a creation, it's going to have a part of you, you know, just like our DNA is within our children.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Pieces of you are in that creative product that you bring forth.
I think that's a good way to put it. It is like your DNA imprint on that, yes.
Sure is. Well, let's get to this wonderful topic of the sacred feminine. I mean, you know, it's been bandied about. I know that that the author Dan Brown certainly brought that to the fore in, I guess, the biggest way. Of course, there were many people who brought it out, and we know that the what is it, the Oh my goodness, I can't think of the word now. Well, you know, those hidden scriptures that were
Nag Hammadi Gospels, the Gnostic Gospels.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. I know it's a little bit of a tongue twister.
Yeah, it escaped me, but all of that brought a lot of this out to the front of this early group, you know, that many suppose that Jesus was a part of and Mary Magdalene were a part of, but of course Dan Brown really brought it out and breathed life into it so that people could actually experience it and begin to do their own research. But let's touch on that a bit. I know that you've done a great deal, and a lot of it is for the basis of your book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think the first thing I would point out is that the sacred feminine should not be confused with feminism or with more political connotations that we have in the modern age, you know, which sort of seek to empower or even sometimes, you know, glorify the feminine. Not that they're totally unconnected, but those things are kind of a distant expression of really a deeper essence. I guess the best definition I can give of the sacred feminine is it's the recognition that God has two faces. God expresses itself in two faces. There's a polarity in the universe, which the ancients often described as masculine and feminine. And they shouldn't even be confused with the sexes in a way, because all of us have components of these two energetic forces within us, so that every male, you know, has a, let's say, a male and a female energy or polarity within him, as does every female have the same type of polar energies present within her. And the sacred feminine was, yes, it did involve worship of the goddess, and it did involve female deities, but again, those are superficial manifestations in that it was really trying to express that as human beings, we approach things in different ways. And the sacred feminine was a recognition of our intuitive nature, of our feeling nature, of leading from the heart, whereas the masculine energy would be more the logical nature, the linear thinking nature, and leading with the mind. Now, to be complete human beings, we need both. You know, you can't just be all heart and no mind, or all mind and no heart. And
right.
I guess I would say that if we want to go anywhere in life, but particularly spiritually, if you think of the feminine or the intuitive as that desire and that inner feeling that there is something out there, that there is a spiritual source out there that we want to connect with, that's sort of the rocket fuel. And the guidance system would actually be the masculine energy, the intellectual proposition that, you know, there's a God out there, that we might even logically come to some conclusion of that. We might read about it. We might study the Bible. We might approach those type of sources, which would be more the masculine approach to it. But it's when you combine those two and you're using all aspects of your being, you're using the intellectual side, you're using the intuitive side, and that you combine those together that we really start to get results and we start to make breakthroughs and get realization. So that in the ancient world, the sacred feminine was really involved many mystical practices that would cultivate people's intuition, cultivate, let's call it, their extrasensory perception or the feeling side of their nature, so that they could go into contemplative and mystical states, and make those connections. And again, you could, when you meditate, there's a couple ways you can go. You can logically direct yourself and say, when I go into my meditation, here's what I want to accomplish. I want to have an experience, an enlightening experience, or I want to touch upon other dimensions. And you can set that as an intellectual goal. But when you're actually in the meditation, you have to use that intuitive feminine side of you to really, you know, kind of make those connections themselves. So that's really, in essence, what the sacred feminine is. Because in history, there's never been a society that's purely patriarchal or purely matriarchal. There's never been truly an Amazon society where, you know, women politically rule and so forth. I mean, I know we've mentioned the Amazons in Homer and, you know, in mythology, and there may have been some societies, you know, like that in the past, but in speaking in general, very few of our famous cultures were either wholly one or either wholly the other. Now, certainly, you know, for the past several thousand years, and particularly with the when the Aryans, who are the ancestors of modern Europeans, seem to always have a little bit more of this sort of masculine deities and a little bit more warlike. And prior to 3000 BC, let's say the early Egyptian culture was decidedly more feminine in orientation. They had more feminine deities, and their approach to things was a little bit more along the mystical line. So we have a great deal of mystical knowledge that came out of ancient Egypt. You know, the Aryans coming along later on were a more warlike society. So sure, we had different, you know, points of emphasis on that spectrum from male to female in different societies, but no society was ever purely one way or purely the other.
Right. Well, you know, I would just venture to say that that would mean self-destruction, completely out of balance. And we look like we could head in that direction if we don't reconnect with more of the feminine here.
Yeah, and that sometimes that's the thing about some of the feminist political movements is that you know, sometimes you get a little bit of reaction and bitterness involved, and it's almost like they would like to push the, you know, spectrum in the other direction. I don't really think that's what it's all about. I think you mentioned the key word, and it's coming into balance, so that I do see a new feminine consciousness arising, but I think it's probably at this point in history going to be more mature, and it's a recognition that it's really arising to address some, let's say, deficits that we have in terms of our approach to life. It's not necessarily to, you know, it's not counter to a patriarchal society in the sense that we want to go from one end of the spectrum to the other, because you're right, that's all out of balance. And the thing is really to make us better human beings by, you know, keeping both of those aspects of our being front and center and trying to keep them into balance. And so I do think that it would certainly have the effect of giving us a better perspective and thinking twice about, as a society, about maybe doing some of the things culturally that we have done in the absence of that feminine force over the last couple thousand years.
Right. Well, you know, we're speaking about the sacred feminine now. What other ancient beliefs would have been suppressed? I mean, we've got the sacred feminine, which was deeply embedded in that core of Judaism, which is really the basis of the three major religions. We have Judaism, we have the Christianity, and we have Islam, and they all come out of Judaism. What would be some of the other aspects that have been suppressed just like crazy?
Well, you know, there's the mystical core, as you mentioned, in the three Abrahamic religions, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. And that mystical core was, you know, again, it was a recognition of the balance of life, that the spirit expressed itself in the material world in two polar forms, in the male and the female. And the belief, another thing that would have been suppressed that was part of that ancient mystical spiritual tradition, because the ancient spiritual tradition that I'm speaking of was pretty universal. It was found in most societies and most cultures in one form or another, including the three major Western religions that we've mentioned. And probably the key thing that was lost or suppressed as these religions became more organized and hierarchical was
political,
absolutely, was the whole notion of the nature of God itself. God in these ancient mystical traditions was not viewed as this sort of, let's call it, an emperor on a throne dispensing justice and punishment according to, you know, whether a person was good or bad, according to the laws that God set up. Now, that notion arose with some of the Jewish patriarchs, and it was carried over into the Roman Empire, which again was, you know, a society that was dominated, male-dominated society. And that notion that human beings were a separate creation, that God was up on the throne, kind of took a lump of clay, created human beings sinned, God punished them, and then we spent the rest of our life trying to atone for the fact that, you know, a woman ate an apple in the Garden of Eden. But that's not the way it was originally held to be. The way it was originally held to be was there was no separation between God and human beings. Human beings were God in material expression. The deity essentially flowed out from its center, and it created numerous separate points of consciousness. But each point of consciousness, as it created in this onward chain of creation, think of it as a ladder of creation. Each rung down the ladder was a little further from the center. And in order to have a separate sense of identity, the one unity had to forget that it was a unity. It had to start thinking of itself as separate identities. So there was a loss of memory involved. The only way, you know, there's an ancient saying by the Hindus that the world is God's playground for forgetting himself. And what and what they really hit on there was that in order for something that is everything, for something that's a unity, to think of something separate outside of itself, it almost has to go through some form of amnesia or some form of separation from the center, where these little parts of the universal consciousness begin to think of themselves encapsulated as little individual self-identities. And that is the true separation between God and humanity. It's really one of consciousness. It's a separation of consciousness, but it's not a separation of essence. We are not little separate lumps of clay like wind-up dolls that God created and breathed life into, as the traditional religions would say, but we were and we are and we always will be of the same essence, but not necessarily of the same consciousness, which is what makes us feel that we are separated from that wholeness.
Right.
So that was perhaps maybe the biggest thing that was lost or suppressed by the organized religions.
Definitely. Well, I guess if you knew that you were God, nobody could control you, right?
You certainly would. If you took that as a basic core belief, you would be searching for remembrance of your identity. And you would be able to do that within yourself because your true identity lies within yourself, which would dispense for the need of a lot of authority figures such as priests,
right,
churches, church hierarchies, and so forth, which, of course, is one of the reasons why this sacred knowledge was suppressed. It didn't really fall into the plan or the scheme of the powers that be, then or now.
Well, I guess their need of keeping the lights on, so to speak, they needed a cash cow to keep it going. And so when you have people in fear, you can control them and manipulate them.
Well, you know, as I've said, I think in the book, that prophets speak the heart of God, their followers start religions, and what that really means is that the original impulse or the vision, the mystical vision of prophets, Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad, were then interpreted by followers who didn't have that direct experience themselves. And when you don't have the direct experience yourself, and interpretation starts to arise, of course, then you have certain people who can start to interpret to their own benefit, for their own benefit. And unfortunately, in this world, there's a lot of people out there who, put power above enlightenment. And so we, get these hierarchical structures, and you get the need to now go through a priest for absolution and to find God through a body like a church, as opposed to understanding that it's not, spirit is not external to yourself, but, as Jesus said, the kingdom is within.
Yes. Now, we talk about quantum physics, quantum mechanics. Now, this was an ancient spiritual tradition that came way before all of this. It was found in the Gnostic Gospels. It was found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, can you talk about that connection of where it was shown before, way ahead of time, before our modern scientists have, rediscovered it, so to speak?
Mm-hmm. If you read the Gnostic Gospels, they were written by some remarkable sages who penetrated the higher dimensions subjectively in their minds in the course of their meditation and brought back information. And the information they brought back could not be scientifically described because 2,000-4,000 years ago, we did not have the technology or the scientific terms to describe
right.
what they saw. So the only way they could take these this information that they had realized in these visions and make it even semi-intelligible to the population at the time was through the only vehicle they had at their command, which was myth. Now, we shouldn't read myth as something that is just these fantastic stories that people make up and they're very imaginative, but, oh, you know, they could never be real. The real sense of myth, the real embodiment of myth is, or the real purpose of myth is to embody some very high and deep truths in symbolic language that can be universally understood if people have the means to interpret it, if they have some of the keys and they have some of the knowledge and the means to interpret the symbolism. So if you read the Gnostic Gospels collectively as a whole, and you strip away the fact that they did not have technological terms and they didn't have atom smashers and, you know, and atomic microscopes and all the instrumentation that quantum physicists use today. But you can see a story that starts to piece together in there, and it sounds remarkably similar to the modern findings of quantum physics. One thing would be the Big Bang, for instance. In the Gnostic Gospels, they said that when the first thought of matter came into the consciousness of the fallen spirits, that it was of a different vibration. And being of a different vibration, the heaven or the spiritual consciousness of heaven could not coexist with the lower vibration of the thought of matter. And it was expelled, a great disturbance occurred in heaven, and that the matter, in effect, was expelled into another dimension. When you think of expelled, it was in a great disturbance. You're talking about some kind of an explosion, in effect. And it's a very, very parallel type of picture that we have with the Big Bang theory today, where they were saying, and the Gnostics said that, you know, reality expressed itself in 10 or more dimensions, and that's exactly what the Big Bang theory says, which is that the material universe contracted from 10 or 11 dimensions down to the three dimensions that we have in a big explosion called the Big Bang, and which was the origin of matter. And this is almost the same story that's being told in the Gnostic Gospels. It's quite remarkable. And you also have the Gnostics are always saying that this world is a construct. If you've seen the movie The Matrix, it's very similar. What they were saying is very similar to what was portrayed in the movie The Matrix, which is that the world is actually a construct, a type of mental construct, which doesn't reflect the true underlying reality, but it reflects an illusion that matter is real in one sense. But it's also an illusion in that it's not the true underlying reality. Now, this is quantum physics itself, because we were raised in a world where we thought Newtonian mechanics explained everything, and we operated in, you know, pretty mathematically mechanical world, and the world was out there. You could touch it, see it, feel it, bend it, even manipulate it to some extent. But when quantum physics came along and they started to understand that the underlying reality is these subatomic particles that don't behave at all like we think what reality is, that they're completely different from, even counterintuitive to the type of world that we know today, where, for instance, there are no such things as particles. There really are no such things as particles and matter. It starts off as a wave, and it only becomes what we consider a particle when some kind of consciousness observes it or imagines it and brings it into the physical state of a particle. So you'd say, but gee, the world is solid, and you know, how can that be? Well, that's what quantum physics says, and that's what the Gnostics were saying. The Gnostics were saying that we really live in almost like a hologram. It's almost like a movie projector that we live in, and there's a certain construct out there of a material consciousness, but behind that is the real movie projector, and behind the real movie projector is the real reality that's being projected. And this kind of gets back into Plato and the allegory of the caves, where humans can only see the shadow, but they can't really see what's behind the shadow. And then, remarkably enough, the latest speculations in hologram theory believe that our universe is essentially almost papered like a quilt patchwork with squares of what might be two-dimensional reality, and they project an image onto the physical world that is not the real reality, but it's the image that we see. And there was an article in New Scientist, and the big headline on the front page was, "You are a hologram." So the Gnostics, again, were predicting this very thing in non-scientific terms, of course, but if you can see the clear parallels there about the holographic nature of our world that quantum physics is talking about today. And you can really go on and on and on to the point where what you really understand is that the scientists are using sophisticated instruments and the scientific method to probe the nature of our reality. And the findings that they're coming up with and the theories that they're coming up with are very similar, if not exactly the same, to what the ancient mystics were saying 2,000 years ago, and yet they approached from the other side of the door. They approached from the mystical, intuitive side and brought the information back subjectively through their own minds and their own meditation, and they would bring this back and they would put this their findings not into scientific papers but into mythical stories. And it was really two different approaches that are astonishingly seem to be deriving pretty much the same type of information about the true nature of our reality.
Powerful. And it seems that in many of these myths that these energies or these substances or powers would become anthropomorphic. They would become in human form. Would you say?
The expression that a lot of people and probably most often the ones that were guilty of this were really the organized religions would be anthropomorphic. They would essentially personalize the spiritual energies in order to make them more understandable and more intelligible to people. Now, today in the modern age, we can understand all the different forces that people talk about, the strong and weak nuclear force, the force of gravity, electromagnetic force, and things of those. Those are things that we've all heard of, so we have a conceptual framework to understand it. People would not have understood that back in ancient times. The easiest way to give them allegorical tools to understand the operation of these forces was to embody them in gods and goddesses.
Right. Right. Now, you're speaking about, because apparently you've read these Gnostic Gospels and the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, would you say that the translations are pretty accurate? So that, because my listeners are some researchers. They're a pretty intellectual group, and they want to go and research this. What would be the best source for actually reading these themselves so that they can decipher this as well?
Well, the best direct source is right online, and you can go to just Google Nag Hammadi Library. There is an online library which is quite good, and it has most of the Gnostic texts are translated there. They call it Nag Hammadi Library, incidentally, because the village in Egypt where the Gospels were discovered in 1945 was closest to the Egyptian village of Nag Hammadi. So that's why they're called the Nag Hammadi Gospels. But the Gospels were written by a group of early Christians called the Gnostics. Well, actually, let me be technically accurate. Gnostics encompassed both Christians and non-Christians, because Gnosticism was an outgrowth of this ancient spiritual movement, this universal wisdom tradition that I talked about. And so when Christianity came along, it was readily embraced by the pre-existing Gnostics, and they became those ones became Gnostic Christians. But the Gnostic Gospels contain both non-Christian Gnostic and Christian Gnostic texts, and they can be found online at the Nag Hammadi Library. To read some scholarly works and interpretations of the Gnostics and help to make your understanding more meaningful, there's two two authors in particular that I like. One is Elaine Pagels from Princeton University, Professor Pagels. I think we owe a great debt to her for making these otherwise very difficult Gospels to understand intelligible to the modern reader. And the second is actually a Gnostic bishop, but he's also a scholar, and his name is Stephen Heller, H-O-E-L-L-E-R. Any of the works by those two, I think, for people who are looking to go further into the study of Gnosticism and the real meaning of Gnosticism, those would be two good places to start, two good sources.
Great. Now, again, that's Elaine Pagels. How would you spell her last name?
Pagels, P-A-G-E-L-S. And she's written a number of books, at least a half a dozen books on different aspects of Gnosticism. And the second author would be Stephen Heller, H-O-E-L-L-E-R. You can research both of them on the web and probably find out the names of some of their books. And for the most part, I think they're pretty readily carried in most bookstores, Borders, or Barnes & Noble.
Great. Now, where would we tie Jesus and Mary Magdalene into this? Were they Gnostics? Were they Jews? Were they Gnostic Jews? Because, of course, Jesus was not a Christian.
Well, and I don't think he was a Gnostic, at least not in his own mind, because I don't think they would have labeled themselves as such, you know, back then. Where they fall
right.
in the where they fall in the spectrum is that the study revealed to me that the teaching, there was an inner and an outer teaching of early Christianity, a public and a private teaching.
Yeah.
And the church, if you the references to this are pretty evident even in the Bible itself, where if you look in Mark and Matthew, and if you look in letters of the early church fathers, such as Clement of Alexandria and Origen, who were both two early church fathers from Alexandria, there are frequent references to the fact that Jesus taught one thing to the masses, but the real sort of mysteries, the deeper mysteries, that he taught those in private to the disciples and a few spiritually mature select individuals. So then the question becomes, well, what was he teaching? This is where the Gnostic Gospels become helpful, because through the Gnostic Gospels, we see Jesus really teaching, I guess you could sort of call him the Western branch of this universal spiritual tradition. Many of the things that he would teach would have striking parallels to Buddhism and Hinduism, references to reincarnation, and this whole idea of the God being humanity in material expression, and primarily expressing itself as the two polar forces of male and female. And Jesus said point blank in many of the Gnostic Gospels that in order to be true human beings and to open the kingdom of heaven, the two must become one. And what he meant by the two becoming one was that each of us as individuals must understand and balance those male and female forces, the intuition and logic, the feeling and the thinking nature of ourselves, in a contemplative way, and balance those forces within us. And that when we did that, then we would start to walk the path of enlightenment and spiritual realization. So he was probably the highest expression we might have had on this earth of this ancient spiritual tradition. But unlike the typical Christian story, which would lead you to believe, well, you know, people were pagan, and then all of a sudden Jesus plunked down on the earth, and all of a sudden people became Christian, and paganism got kind of a bad name, and, you know, that's sort of the view of history we have, but it didn't happen that way at all. The ancient goddess worship, the Eleusinian rites, the Magna Mater and everything else was part of this ancient spiritual tradition, and this is essentially what Jesus was teaching. He had a very feminine orientation in terms of strengthening and bringing back the feminine part of the equation, which had been greatly weakened by patriarchal societies like the Hebrews and the Romans and so forth, and he was trying to bring it back into balance, and he would have been, in his time, he would have been considered a very, very radical feminist in that regard, and that was why he elevated women so much. So many, there were at least seven female disciples that can be traced in biblical history, Mary Magdalene being the foremost of them. And Mary Magdalene was the one, according to the Gnostic Gospels, to whom not only did he impart the deepest mysteries, but the one who best understood them. So that when we have scenes in the Gnostic Gospels, when Jesus was speaking with the disciples, Mary Magdalene was almost acting as a co-instructor in the mysteries to the other disciples. And that was how great her understanding was of these things.
Powerful. Well, we know that the church fathers labeled her as harlot. I mean, that was a clever way of trying to push out that sacred feminine, because she was certainly a representative of that.
Yeah, they've since pulled back on that and acknowledged that that was either a mistake, either intentional or unintentional, by one of the medieval popes. But certainly there was. It really kind of unfolded this way. The outer church and the inner church developed in tandem for a while. And for a while, the female leaders were probably even more prominent than the males, and probably those female leaders understood the true inner message that Jesus was teaching, the real mystical core, better than many of the men did. And they were, Mary Magdalene was a very powerful and well-respected early female leader. As the outer church evolved, it was seeking to become accepted in the Roman Empire, even to become the state religion of the Roman Empire. And in the Roman Empire, as with both the Greek and Hebrew societies, there was still a lot of political and economic prejudice against women, and women were not considered fit to be rulers or direct rulers. So having so many female leaders and having a movement that was so feminine orientation and characterized by female leadership started to become an embarrassment to the outer church, the what we call the public church. And they started to push the females aside gradually. It was a gradual process. It didn't happen overnight. But the one thing that I could tell you all that was very interesting that symbolizes this whole trend is that in the city of Ephesus, where it was said that Mary Magdalene died, and also Mary, the mother of Jesus, was supposed to have died.
Now,
in Asia.
Ephesus, that's is that in Turkey?
It is. It's in modern-day Turkey. Of course, Turkey,
okay.
Turkey in those days was really a collection of Greek cities. Ancient Turkey was actually Southern Italy was really part of the Greek world in those days, and it became part of the Greco-Roman world. So that the cities like Ephesus, there were a lot of magnificent cities in Asia Minor and modern Turkey. They were Greco-Roman cities in those days, and Mary Magdalene and Mother Mary were said to have died in Ephesus, and it became a very strong, was one of the seven original churches. It became a very strong place for the Christian religion to develop. And there are some caves above Ephesus. And in these caves, it's very interesting because there's a mural, and it depicts St. Paul, and he's flanked by two women, Thecla and Theoclia. It was a mother and daughter. And the mother was these were both historically documented to have been traveling companions of St. Paul and teachers, just like he was. Paul held them to be his equals. And it's very clear that the mother was a figure of authority, because if you look at the portraits of the mother and Paul, they're both holding their right hand up in a very particular position, which is called the sign of authority, the sign of the bishop, which is the index and middle fingers are crossed, and then the thumb and another finger are kind of crossed beneath them. The picture's a little bit hard to get, but it's a particular sign that they used to make, and it's called the sign of the bishop today, and so it was also called the sign of authority. What it indicated was a high figure of authority or a teacher in the Christian church. And both Paul and Theoclia were making the sign of the bishop. What happened was that somebody chipped away the face of Theoclia and chipped away the fingers where she was making the sign of authority. So this was probably a physical expression of the growing antipathy towards women in the church and the embarrassment of them as church leaders that certain people were trying to erase. Because at one time she was obviously held in very high regard, but then at a later date, as the outer Christianity developed, she became part of this embarrassment of having the female leadership. So someone was sort of trying to eradicate her record of being a teacher. This is the same thing that happened to Mary Magdalene. This is the same thing that happened to other women of the church. Unfortunately, so much was destroyed and so much lost, we may never know, you know, to what extent. But it's clear that this trend was underway, and it culminated around 325 when Constantine made Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire under an all-male cast of bishops that he designated to sort of set the dogma and the creed of the Christian church. And by that time, the women were sort of pretty thoroughly out of the picture. And one other interesting point I'll mention before we go on to something else is that some people, including an author named Ramon Jusino, J-U-S-I-N-O, and you can Google him in the internet, I think his work is on the internet, wrote an essay about how the Gospel of John was originally the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, and that Mary Magdalene was in fact the beloved disciple in the Bible, and that later Christian leaders, in this effort to make the church more male and more acceptable to the Roman Empire, altered the original Gospels and diminished the role of Mary Magdalene. But she was such a powerful figure back then, they could not eliminate her completely. So essentially, they made the Gospel of Mary, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene became the Gospel of John, and Mary became the beloved disciple, a nebulous figure who we don't really know. But they couldn't erase the fact that she was the first one to see the risen Jesus, and that she was she stayed all through the crucifixion when the male disciples fled, and so forth. So they could diminish her, but they couldn't completely expunge her identity.
No, they couldn't. You know, and the fact that she was right there and was always right there and with such a connection with Jesus was the favored one. Of course, we wonder if they were a couple. And, of course, this has been bandied about quite a bit. From what you know, I mean, with Jesus being who he was, I mean, in the ancient world, a man did not get past a certain age without being married.
Well, you know, that was sort of the theme of Dan Brown's book, and I have a little bit of a different take on that. I think people spend way too much time speculating whether Jesus and Mary were married and had children. It could be. It's possible. I personally don't believe it, but that doesn't mean it's not true. There's a possibility that it is, and I hold out that possibility. But regardless, I don't attach a lot of importance to it. My own take on that is that Dan Brown said, well, Mary Magdalene was the Holy Grail, meaning the repository of Jesus' progeny, the mother of his children. I also think Mary Magdalene was the Holy Grail, but I think that she was the repository of something far more important, which was Jesus' gnosis, his secret inner teaching. It's very clear that Mary Magdalene, through the Gnostic Gospels, had the firm grasp of the inner teaching, and that she was the primary disciple. It was not St. Peter who was the foundation back then. It was Mary Magdalene who was the foundation. In fact, so much so that many early Christian sects held her to be the full counterpart to the Christ, that whereas Christ was the Logos or the Word of God embodied, Mary Magdalene was the Holy Spirit embodied. And this was, again, the operation of the male and the female force. The two must become one.
Right.
The polar representations of the male and female, Jesus and Mary were the earthly embodiments of these spiritual forces. And many, many early Christians held Mary Magdalene to that higher regard, that she was a co-equal, the Holy Spirit being a co-equal with the Christ. So to me, that's far more important aspect of Mary Magdalene than whether or not they were actually married and have had children, which might be of some little historical significance, but really doesn't make that much difference for any of us, you know, from a spiritual standpoint.
Right. And it just, you know, like you alluded to, that this was what the ancient world believed. There was always that feminine balance to the male. And so, of course, he would have to have that counterpart. I mean, it was just part of the belief system, and of course, a part of nature, which is what this belief system came out of.
You could almost view the Christian story, the true Christian story, as the last hurrah in the Western world for the restoration of the feminine balance, and it failed. Essentially, it failed. It wasn't eradicated, but it was close to being eradicated. And I think the desire and the real interest people have now in Mary Magdalene and the sacred feminine is to recover that whole lost tradition that unfortunately Mary and Jesus were not able to instill into the mass of humanity. But I don't know that human beings were ready human society back at that time was ready for that message. I mean, certainly it had an effect, and Christianity affected the world, albeit in a highly altered form. But the true form of Christianity never seeped into the mass consciousness except through the Gnostics, and the Gnostics were eventually destroyed. But it never was eradicated. Gnosticism has cropped up continually. The tarot is all about Gnostic symbology. The troubadours of the Middle Ages, the Cathars, the Masons, the Rosicrucians, all these movements, even the New Age today, is all directly based on the ancient spiritual tradition of Gnosticism. They're all offshoots of it that just keep cropping up perennially because the truth will out. You can suppress the truth, but you can't eradicate it. It will come
you
out.
Cannot.
And I think, yeah. And I think that's what I think the expression of trying to recapture the sacred feminine is trying to recapture that truth and bring the world back into balance.
That's right. Peter Canova, author of Pope Annalisa, I thank you so much for joining us once again here on Illuminations Radio. I'm knowing that as soon as that next book, what is the title again?
It's called The 13th Disciple, and I might mention at this juncture that Pope Annalisa, if you cannot find it in the bookstores, it can be ordered through any bookstore, or you can order it off Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, Borders, any of the online bookstores. And you can also get more information about the themes that we've been talking about at my website, PopeAnnalisa.com. That's PopeAnnalisa.com. It's got a lot of videos and a lot of terrific background information for those of you that would like to go deeper into the subject matter.
Fantastic. I thank you all for joining us here, our crew. I see Papa Jude in there. I see Hakima. Thank you so much for joining us again. We're going to be back. As I said, we'll be back on the 8th. We're going to take a little break for the holidays, and we're going to be back at our new time,